Welcome to today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, May 18th. I'm your reader, Wanda, and here is our first story. Federal relief funds will offset but not fully cover UNI's pandemic losses by Andrew Wind. Federal emergency relief funds given to the University of Northern Iowa will offset losses due to the COVID-19 pandemic but won't completely cover them. One of our greatest areas of financial loss, including the Department of Residents, noted UNI spokesman Steve Schmendecki in an emailed response to questions. The university has experienced a loss of more than $5 million due to refunding of fees for students who moved out of our residence halls at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. The university received $7.62 million in federal assistance through the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. Half of that money must be awarded to students in the form of grants, leaving UNI with about $3.8 million for its institutional needs. The university is still working through budget scenarios and has not finalized the use of the remaining balance, said Schmendecki. According to the Iowa Department of Education documents, the CARES Act is providing $71.6 million to Iowa's 327 public school districts, $36.13 million to its 15 community colleges, $33 million to the three public universities, and $33.5 million to private colleges and universities across the state, and $2.7 million to for-profit higher education institutions. Asked about the possibility of layoffs or job eliminations due to the revenue shortfalls, Schmendecki said many potential scenarios are being discussed by administration and shared governance units. We'll know more about whether future losses require these actions when we have a clearer picture about what to expect in terms of governmental appropriations as well as fall tuition revenue. In addition, he noted, officials are still looking at the possibility of more help from Congress. Our governmental relations team is exploring a potential next federal relief package in coordination with colleges and universities across the United States as part of a broader advocacy effort focused on protecting education access, he said. In the meantime, student grants are already being given to UNI's potential priority applicants. Eligibility depends on completion of a free application for students' aid prior to the current academic year and incurring expenses related to COVID-19 disruptions of campus operations. Additional funds will be awarded based on availability. Officials said student applications are in process at Hawkeye Community College, which received $1.77 million. Students can apply online for the money, which they note is available to those enrolled in credit courses who received a federal Pell Grant. Student services or a student success coordinator can help with the process. What we're prioritizing is what will be the most impactful for our students, said Dion Somerville, Vice President of Student Affairs. The student grant portion of the CARES Act is a nice complement to assistance Hawkeye already provides to those in need through its foundation, food pantry, and loans of laptop computers. Still, we are keeping track of costs we're incurring, said Dan Gillen, Hawkeye Chief Financial Officer. That includes such things as additional video conferencing licenses, computer network equipment, cleaning supplies, and protective items for situations where it is difficult to socially distance. The college money can be used for these costs that we incur because of the pandemic. Along with other public and private higher education institutions, the federal funds are available to training schools. Among those receiving money are LaJames International College and the Salon Professional Academy, both in Cedar Falls. According to an Iowa College Aid document, they have been allocated $22,241 and $123,699, respectively. Waterloo Community Schools received $2.6 million through the federal relief funds. Of that, $265,000 is allocated to non-public schools within district borders boundaries. The plan is being developed over time as the funds need to be spent by December 2022, said Michael Coughlin, Waterloo School Chief Financial Officer. Cedar Falls Community Schools received $337,361, with $23,551 of that for nonprofit schools. At this time, we will utilize the funds for additional costs the district has incurred during the pandemic, said Superintendent Andy Patti. The money will also help with some items in the budget where revenue was not received due to COVID-19. Cedar Valley Catholic Schools, Bosco Catholic Schools, and Waterloo Christian School are dividing the Waterloo funds. St. Patrick's Catholic School and Valley Lutheran School are receiving the Cedar Falls money. Coughlin said public schools receive funds based on a formula accounting for poverty levels. Non-public school allocations are based on enrollment. As Iowa reopens, state's coronavirus data elusive, by Vanessa Miller. For the past 9 weeks, 68-year-old Debbie Buck has been isolating with her husband, Dennis Fett, at their rural home and peacock farm in western Iowa's Pottawatomie County, which has seen its known cases of coronavirus spike over 300% in 2 weeks. For most, if not all of that time, she has been tuning in to watch Governor Kim Reynolds' nearly daily updates, eagerly awaiting what she perceived as among the most important information, the numbers of new cases and deaths. At first, Reynolds announced daily COVID-19 cases and deaths by county, including the age ranges of those who became infected or died. As the tally swelled, Reynolds' office with the Iowa Department of Public Health assigned regional scores as a way of evaluating the pandemic spread, tying the overall score to setting public policies. But then, in early May, Ms. Reynolds' reporting practices changed. She stopped announcing daily cases and deaths on TV. She stopped sending out those statistics to news releases to the media and posts to the governor's website. She instead unveiled a new coronavirus.iowa.gov website showing total cases, deaths, and tests on a statewide and county level. It provided statewide demographic data in percentages, but not raw numbers and not by county. The dashboard on the revised website includes a range of other COVID-19 metrics, like numbers of Iowans who have recovered, percentage of positive tests, and long-term care outbreaks. But while the site provides graphics showing cases and recoveries over time, it does not provide such a timeline graphic for deaths, making it hard for Iowans to easily gauge whether they're rising or falling. The site also fails to provide demographic data by county for cases, recoveries, and deaths, including age range, gender, race, and ethnicity. It provides those demographic details only in statewide percentages, not raw numbers. Without the governor's daily announcement, Buck, scrambling for a way to gauge her state's progress in fighting COVID-19, began keeping her own spreadsheet and doing her own math. I had to add and subtract and figure out how many deaths there were, she told the Gazette. I have been keeping my own chart and tally since this new website started. Reynolds' decision to de-emphasize the number of new cases and deaths on television and to stop providing demographic data for communities, including that overall regional score she had pointed to as important in setting policy, comes at a time she is increasing the ability of Iowans to sit down for a meal at a restaurant, get a haircut, work out at a gym, and go shopping. Reynolds said Iowans would need to decide for themselves, taking into account their own circumstances, whether to venture out. Everybody is going to make their own decisions, she said. Even though we have eased the mitigation requirements on some of our businesses, restaurants, salons, churches, you still have individual business. Some are ready to open up and they're moving forward. Others are continuing to make sure that they can do it in a safe and responsible manner. And then Iowans are going to take the responsibility to decide if they are ready to go out and participate at the businesses or go to a restaurant. But Western Iowa's Buck asked, how can Iowans do that without accessible and consumable information about community spread at the local level? It seems to me she's trying to avoid it, especially the death count, so people don't hear it, she said. If you don't hear it and don't think about it, it will go away, and it will be okay to open up. That concerns me. Addressing concerns about the data being released, Governor's spokesman Pat Garrett praised the timeliness of the revamped website, noting the state is giving Iowans more information than they had before. Instead of updating news conference viewers with numbers that already are a day old, Garrett said, the website now provides data as of 11:59 p.m., and the state is working to make it more timely with updates more regularly, he said. What we are providing is much more timely data than we've ever had before, he said. Nevertheless, that more current data still is available 11 hours before Reynolds goes on live TV. Providing it on the website and instead of also on television does not reach Iowans who don't have the internet access or familiarity on how to use it. As to removal from its website of regional COVID-19 rankings previously used to assess the severity of the pandemic spread across Iowa, Garrett said that data has lost relevance. With Test Iowa, the state now has the ability to drill down to a county, city, zip code to analyze the spread of the virus and determine mitigation strategies, he said. But the state has not shared that level of local data with the public. Garrett didn't address the Gazette's questions about what the state isn't providing, why the state isn't providing the same data and graphics for deaths as it is for other metrics, or why the governor stopped announcing daily cases and deaths during her TV briefings. After fielding a range of queries from reporters about the data gaps, however, Reynolds opened her news conference Friday in a more familiar fashion, first announcing, "Over the week, we have seen our positive case count stabilize. Today, we are reporting that we have 374 new positive cases and 3,888 negative cases," she said. "Days to double continues to improve. Today, it's 18 days, which speaks to the slowing of the spread of the virus." She reported, "Unfortunately, 18 Iowans have lost their lives to COVID-19. In response to media questions earlier in the week, Reynolds asserted that information is not being limited. "We're trying to provide more access to Iowans, and we're trying to do it in a more timely fashion," she said, noting she too felt some frustration in navigating the changing website. "Even as I'm trying to manage those through the system, it's changed. It's changing daily as we're learning more and trying to provide Iowans with more timely information," Reynolds said. "I like the graphics, but it is changing and it is fluid right now." Iowa Department of Public Health Deputy Director Sarah Resetter said her department is taking the feedback and making adjustments. "I can tell you that they're actively working to provide some more information," she said. "We're doing it carefully. We're doing it diligently. But we do expect in the next week or so to be able to provide some more functionality. And some of the things that you're referencing that are currently lacking, I would expect to see some of them come back for you." The information is coming late, though, as many previously shuttered parts of Iowa's economy already have blinked back to life, reigniting marketplace competition and putting some business owners in a tight spot, according to Senator Claire Kelsey, Democrat, West Des Moines. What I've been getting is, why don't they track county-level data anymore?" she said, of the feedback she has received from constituents. "If you have a business in Polk County or in Johnson County, you want to know what the data is among your customers," she said. "They're the ones that are going to be frequenting your business." Kelsey said lawmakers, like the public, stopped getting the daily case and death totals they relied on, prompting her to reach out to the governor's office for more information. But her follow-up questions have gone unanswered, she said, and it's frustrating. "Nobody's personally blaming Kim Reynolds for the pandemic," she said, "but they are now starting to blame her for any actions moving forward that involve opening up the state without data to support it. And I think that's where I would hold her." Kelsey said she sent emails to the public health department asking for information, arguing, "You guys keep telling us this data is here, and it's not." Reynolds has urged Iowans with questions or concerns to call. Although there is no clear number for data-related questions on the website dashboard, Senator Joe Bolcom of Democrat Iowa City said he too has concerns about changes in how the state is reporting data. He also has started maintaining his own spreadsheet. The new dashboard made it really significantly harder for Iowans to track the day-to-day progress of the pandemic, unless you looked at the website yesterday and wrote down the numbers the day before that or the day before that, he said. It just doesn't make any sense. We're collecting the data. We should make it available to Iowans with an interest in tracking this pandemic. That, according to Bolcom, should include data on testing, which experts and analysts have heralded as paramount to any reopening effort. Although the governor's dashboard shows total testing, county-level testing, and a daily progression of testing in Iowa, it does not break down the numbers by type or mode of testing, including how much has been accomplished under the $26 million Test Iowa initiative. Instead, the state's dashboard is providing only the number of Test Iowa assessments Iowans have completed to determine who qualifies for a test. Assuming the state has this information, daily numbers of tests by type and demographic details at the local level, 69-year-old Dennis Fett, who said he voted for Reynolds, argues the governor should release it. I don't care if she tells me bad news, he said. I just want to know it so I can make my own decisions. Iowa Supreme Court rejects challenges to judicial nomination changes by James Q. Lynch. Cedar Rapids. The Iowa Supreme Court has rejected two challenges to changes in the state judicial nominating process, ending an attempt to overturn what they argued was politicizing of the panel that nominates judges. In both cases, the Supreme Court said in a one-sentence ruling late Friday that after considering the challenges, further review was denied. The Supreme Court had been asked to reverse a pair of 3-2 decisions by the Iowa Court of Appeals that found the plaintiffs lacked standing to challenge the lawmakers' actions in the 2019 session. In one case, the challenge was brought by Democratic lawmakers as well as a current former member of the Nomination Commission. The other was brought by an attorney who unsuccessfully applied for a seat on the appeals court. Bob Rush, a Cedar Rapids attorney who was part of the original challenge, called the Supreme Court ruling the most disappointing decision in 50 years of practice. It sends the wrong message. It tells legislators the Constitution can be ignored if they have the votes, said Rush, himself a former lawmaker. However, Governor Kim Reynolds called the decision good news for the rule of law and for Iowans who will have a greater voice in the process of selecting our judges. The Attorney General's office deferred comment to the governor, simply saying its arguments were based on the question of standing. Since the change in the law, Reynolds has appointed 4 Supreme Court justices, a majority of the court, including Chief Justice Susan Christensen. The latest appointee, Matthew McDermott, did not participate in either decision handed down Friday. The plaintiffs raised a challenge to Senate File 638, which made changes in how members of the Judicial Nominating Committee are selected to allow the governor to pick the majority of the panel. The original case was rejected for a lack of standing. The plaintiffs refiled, and a current and former member of the Nominating Commission joined the 8 Democratic legislators and Rush. The second challenge was raised by Thomas Duff, a Des Moines attorney who applied for the appeals court appointment. That was not enough to give him standing. The appeals court ruled in February. The lawmakers who brought the challenge were Representatives Mary Masher of Iowa City, Art Stead and Liz Bennett of Cedar Rapids, Rick Olson, Marty Anderson, and Brian Meyer of Des Moines, Mark Smith of Marshalltown, and Mary Wolf of Clinton. Martin Diaz and Leanne Spies joined them after the initial ruling that the plaintiffs did not have standing. In making their cases, the plaintiffs said the GOP-controlled legislature violates rules against log rolling by including unrelated matters in one bill and the requirement that the title of the bill contain the subject matter. In this case, the title included no mention of the Judicial Nominating Commission. They also challenged the change to allow the governor to choose the majority of judicial nominating commissioners. Previously, the Judicial Nominating Commission was 8 members of the bar, 8 governor appointees, and the senior Supreme Court member. Lawmakers eliminated the role of the senior justice and gave the governor a 9th appointee, giving the governor a majority on the commission. Blackhawk County looks to protect gravel roads by Tim Jamison. Blackhawk County is experimenting with a new process to protect its gravel roads from frost boils. Members of the County Board of Supervisors last week approved the first phase of a contract to install sub-drains and a stabilizing material along about 2 miles of Ainsboro and Hammond Avenues near Schrock Road. County engineer Kathy Nicholas said the estimated $165,000 project will determine whether the process is a way to prevent devastating frost boils that shut down many rural roads last spring. That was a bad spring, Nicholas said. We had many roads that were impassable, and me telling many citizens that we really can't help you at this point. This is an attempt to start working on some of our busiest roads, roads that see very heavy truck traffic, roads that have hog confinements, roads that we really like to see become more sustainable in the future in become all weather, she added. A harsh winter and record precipitation combined last year to wreak havoc on gravel roads across the state. Water trapped in the roadbed went through a freeze-thaw cycle that heaved material up and left holes that swallowed gravel placed by county road crews. The $60,000 contract, approved by a 4-to-1 board vote, will install longitudinal drains to drain away water from the road. A second contract, to be approved in the future, will mill up about 8 inches of the road, mix it with a stabilizer, and place it back down. Supervisor Tom Little voted against the project after expressing concerns about county road funding being cut due to COVID-19 pandemic. I'm not opposed to the project, Little said. I just think the timing's bad on spending roughly $160,000 on something that's more of an experiment to see if it's going to help. We have no idea what the future is going to bring, he added. This is a program I think we can pick back up next year and start it. Nicholas said her department is taking steps to reduce expenses after the Iowa Department of Transportation indicated local governments could see a 25% to 40% drop in road use tax revenues because fewer motorists are buying gas during the coronavirus pandemic. We are decreasing our operational expenses. We are decreasing our salary and benefits to a point, and we would also be decreasing some of our local construction, Nicholas said. We are going to defer capital purchases for as long as we can. We are hoping our economy bounces back, and by late this year, we'll be back to in a normal, more normal place, she added. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Mary Rosalia Knebel, K-N-E-B-E-L, 85 of Jessup, died Friday, May 15th at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center, Waterloo. She was born September 13th, 1934 in Waterloo, daughter of Matthias Ortner and Margaret Loretta Brown Ortner. She married John Joseph Knebel on April 4th, 1959 at St. Francis Catholic Church, Barclay, rural Dunkerton. He died March 27th, 1997. After John's death, Mary worked for 19 years in the Jessup Community School lunchroom before retirement. Survivors include a daughter, Susan, husband, Chad Freeman, of Independence, a son, Larry, wife, Janet Knebel, of Webb City, Missouri, four grandchildren, Jordan, wife, Jessica Knebel, Colton Roman, Joanna Roman, and Courtney Freeman, four great-grandchildren, a brother, Richard Ortner of Jessup, and a sister, Helen Weber of Raymond. She was preceded in death by her husband, John, her parents, two brothers, Robert Ortner in infancy, and John Ortner, and three sisters, Dorothy Youngblood, Kathleen Sorensen, and Dolores Kimmel. Private family visitation will be Monday, May 18th, at the White Funeral Home, 1315 Main Street, Jessup. A drive-by visitation at the funeral home will be 4:30 to 6 p.m. on Monday. The parish rosary at 5 p.m. Monday will be broadcast to car radios at 88.5 FM. Private services will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 19th at St. Athanasius Catholic Church in Jessup. The Mass will be live-streamed at www.saintaparish.com, burial in the church cemetery. Memorials to St. Athanasius Catholic School in Jessup or to Camp Courageous of Iowa in Monticello. Online condolences at www.white-mounthope.com. Cecil Haben Powers, 94 of Waterloo, died Thursday, May 14th at Lakeview Landing of Friendship Village of natural causes. She was born February 14th, 1926 in Iowa Falls, daughter of Edward and Grace Campbell Haben. Cecil graduated from Rhinebeck High School in 1943 and Iowa State College in 1947 with a degree in Applied Art Home Economics. She taught home economics in Hudson and Monroe, Iowa, directed the Blackhawk County Dairy Council, and consulted at the Lighting Center of Waterloo. Cecil taught applied art classes at the YWCA. She received the State of Iowa 4-H Alumni Award in 1970 and the Iowa State University Service Award in 1992. Cecil married J. Robert Powers, June 11, 1955, at St. Joseph Rectory in Waterloo. He died March 20, 2014. Survivors include three sons, Michael of Hiram, Ohio, Bradley, wife Carrie of Tampa, Florida, and Steve, wife Joni of Glendale, Arizona. A brother, Dwayne, wife Betty Haben of Dyke, a sister-in-law, Lorraine Haben of Waterloo, of Webster City, 10 grandchildren, Austin, wife Sarah, Ben, wife Libby, Catherine, wife Sophia, Jordan, Grace, husband Felix, Aubrey, Colin, Sam, Megan, and Cam. And a great-grandson, Bradley Burton Ayub. She was preceded in death by her husband, Bob, her parents, and a brother, Lynn Haben. Services will be held at Waterloo First United Methodist Church at a later date. The body will be cremated with burial at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Locke Funeral Home is in charge of arraignments. Memorials to Waterloo First United Methodist Church or the Friendship Village Auxiliary. Online condolences at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Cecil organized her family annual summer reunions, Camp Cousins, for more than 30 years and made an annual picture memory scrapbook for each grandchild. She also enjoyed quilting, making crib quilts for each of her 10 grandchildren, and crafting each child a full-size quilt masterpiece. Dale Francis Vestal, 77, of New Hampton, died Friday, May 15th, at home under the care of St. Croix Hospice. He was born August 3rd, 1942, in Marble Rock, son of Evander and Florence Lucille Freeman Vestal, V-E-S-T-A-L. He graduated from New Hampton High School in 1960. He served in the U.S. Army, stationed in West Germany. He worked at Chamberlain Industries, and in 1994, he took a job with DCI Industries before retiring at the age of 62. He married Brenda Sorensky on August 10, 1991, at Zion Lutheran Church in Alta Vista. Survivors include his wife, two sons, Mark Vestal of North Carolina and Craig Vestal of Tulsa, Oklahoma, a daughter, Jenny Vestal of Cedar Rapids, 11 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren, a sister, Lois Betts of New Hampton, his father and mother-in-law, Punk and Jean Sorensky of Alta Vista, two sister-in-laws, Lori, husband Daryl Hansen of New Hampton, Tammy, husband George Rivera of Charles City, and three brother-in-laws, Keith, wife Marcia Sorensky of Mason City, Kent, wife Teresa Sorensky of Clemmy, and Tom Harriet of Cedar Rapids. He was preceded in death by his parents, his siblings, Bernadine George, Phyllis Carr, Lynn Vestal, and Marlis Harriet, and a grandson, Vincent Vestal. A celebration of life service will be held at a later date with interment in the New Hampton City Cemetery. Military honors will be conducted by the New Hampton American Legion Post. Hugeback Johnson Funeral Home and Cemetery is in charge of arraignments. Dale fought the good fight, and he did so with his soulmate and with a sense of humor that lifted up those who knew him, even when he was in the fight of his life. He will be missed. Mayor's Top Teen Awards, Mother Moon Scholarships announced. The 22nd annual Mayor's Top Teen Awards and Mother Moon Service Scholarships were presented virtually by the Volunteer Center of Cedar Valley on May 12th. The awards program, typically held in person, recognizes outstanding youth volunteers in the Cedar Valley. Area award criteria included demonstrating excellence in volunteerism in the Cedar Valley and setting a good example as a role model for others. Teens ages 13 to 18 are eligible for the award. The 27 nominees received certificates from Waterloo Mayor Quinton Hart, Cedar Falls Mayor Rob Green, and Evansdale Mayor Troy Beatty. In addition, the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa awarded Mother Moon Service Scholarships to 9 students. Sponsors of the event included the cities of Cedar Falls, Dunkerton, Evansdale, Gilbertville, Hudson, LaPorte City, Raymond, and Waterloo. Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa, R.J. McElroy Trust, and Volunteer Center of Cedar Valley. This year's nominees are as followed. Mariah Ambrose is a top teen award winner from Waterloo East High School. Maria dedicates her time on Sundays teaching lessons and songs with movement to kids as a Sunday school teacher. Mariah is a student ambassador through UNI's Educational Talent Search Program. As part of this program, she has volunteered with PAC, the Dome for the Martin Luther King Jr. National Day of Service, assisted elders at the Jesse Cosby Center, and helped plan a clothing drive for Goodwill, among other leadership opportunities. Mariah is one of the Mother Moon Scholarship recipients. Jenna Atkins is a top teen award winner from Cedar Falls High School. Jenna volunteers in the emergency room at Mercy One. Since December, she has spent over 100 hours running labs, cleaning, restocking supplies, and providing support to patients. She also had the opportunity to shadow a doctor on duty. Vakash Ayappan, AYYAPPAN, is a top teen award winner from Cedar Falls High School. Vakash, VIKASH, is a volunteer at both Mercy One Medical Center in Waterloo and Cedar Falls. He is a performer and master of ceremonies at the Kids Way Big Top 10 at the Sturgis Falls Celebration. Vakash has also performed as a magician at Northeast Iowa Indian Association events and has helped kids at the Hearst Center for the Arts. Vakash is one of the Mother Moon Scholarship recipients. Hannah Carey is a top teen award winner from Waterloo East High School. Hannah has volunteered for Pennies for Patients at the Children's Hospital, served as a summer Bible camp counselor, spent time meal packing for Feed My Starving Children and UNI's Pack the Dome and Ring Bells for the Salvation Army. She also volunteered with the Christmas Adopt-A-Family program. Bethany Christians is a top teen award winner from Dunkerton High School. Bethany volunteers at the Cedar Bend Humane Society and makes toys and blankets for shelter animals. She has coordinated numerous volunteer opportunities as VP of Logistics through National Honor Society. Bethany also participated in cross country, basketball, and track. She was one of the Mother Moon Scholarship recipients. Tyson Fletchner is a top teen award winner from LaPorte City Union High School. He was invited to events at LaPorte City FFA Museum, giving him the opportunity to interact with and teach children about chickens and agriculture. As a lead member of the Union Carolers, Tyson brings the joy of music to his local area during the holidays. He is a Mother Moon Scholarship recipient. Candace Griggs is a top teen award winner from Waterloo East High School. Cadence is a cadet commander sergeant major, the highest enlisted cadet in her battalion with the U.S. Army Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps program. She has completed over 110 hours of volunteer service with the Ceremonial Color Guard as a peer mentor with the Mentors of Violence Prevention Program and helping veterans through the Blackhawk County VA. Laura Hepworth is a top teen award winner from Waterloo West High School. Within the last year, she has spent more than 100 hours volunteering with her church, Orange Elementary School, Cedar Bend Humane Society, Northeast Iowa Food Bank, and County View Care Center. She also volunteers with her school's freshman mentoring program called Link Crew, National Honor Society, and Students Against Destructive Decisions. Laura is a Mother Moon Scholarship recipient. Laura Hepworth is a top teen award winner from Waterloo West High School. Within the last year, she has spent more than 100 hours volunteering at her church, Orange Elementary School, Cedar Bend Humane Society, Northeast Iowa Food Bank, and Country View Care Center. Emma Hickman is a top teen award winner from Waterloo West High School. She volunteers with Feed My Starving Children, her church, Northeast Iowa Food Bank, the Grout Museum, House of Hope, Caden Closet, Aspire, and the Cedar Bend Humane Society. Reagan Lindsay is a top teen award winner from Columbus High School. She has volunteered with the annual Mayor's Fun Run for Kids, helped run her school's seventh grade retreat, assisted with girls' basketball and volleyball camps at her school, and helped at the Hawkeye National Wrestling Tournament. She also participates in athletics, student government, musicals, and National Honor Society. Lily Mayer is a top teen award winner from Columbus High School. Over the past year, she has spent time volunteering as part of her church's youth ministry at local elementary schools and the hospital. She also, with her cheerleading team, hosted a fall festival, served meals at a local, and helped local schools with summer cleanup projects. Lily is a Mother Moon Scholarship recipient. Latasha McGee is a top teen award winner from Waterloo East High School. Latasha volunteers with the Ceremonial Color Guard, serves meals and supports veterans at her local American Legion, and mentors middle schoolers in a leadership development program. She also works part-time, serves as a council member to the Waterloo Youth City Council, and participates in athletics. Abigail Pete is a top teen award winner from Hudson High School. She has spent more than 120 hours volunteering with her church, Vacation Bible School, Teen Serve, Northeast Iowa Food Bank, Feed My Starving Children, local veterans. Tristan Prowse is a top teen award winner from LaPorte City Union High School. She has spent nearly 200 volunteer hours with her church's prayer shawl ministry and making hats for infants through the American Red Cross. She also volunteered with the Northern Iowa Youth Orchestra. Jessica Regenweather is a top teen award winner from Hudson High School. She began volunteering with her church's Vacation Bible School more than 10 years ago and now serves as a kindergarten teacher for the program. Her involvement in National Honor Society has also given her the opportunity to lead her peers in volunteering with the American Red Cross, the Northeast Iowa Food Bank, and Dance Marathon for the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital. Sarah Roberts, a top teen award winner from LaPorte City Union High School. Sarah can be found volunteering with Student Council, Future Farmers of America, German Club, and at her church. She also was a volunteer teacher for elementary summer school students. Sarah participates in her school's mentorship program, dance team, speech and drama, band, choir, and softball. Kylie Saley is a top teen award winner from Hudson High School. Kylie is a four-sport athlete, the student body vice president, member of the yearbook, and managing editor of the newspaper. Through National Honor Society, she has volunteered with the American Red Cross, Northeast Iowa Food Bank, and Dance Marathon for the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital. She also helped lead the charge for her school's backpack program, ensuring families in need receive food each week. Kylie is a Mother Moon scholarship recipient. Lincoln Sauer is a top teen award winner from Waterloo East High School. As a surgical host volunteer, she worked closely with patients' families. She was injured in a bike racing accident and became a patient herself. Lincoln still volunteers with Mercy One, although she now devotes her time to the birth center and pediatrics department. Riley Sash is a top teen award winner from LaPorte City Union High School. She's president of the Benton County Youth Council, a 4-H leadership group. She also volunteers with her school's chapter of Future Farmers of America and mentors in violence protection program for incoming freshmen. Claire Schaefer is a top teen award winner from Columbus High School. She coaches youth volleyball and plans events through student government, such as canned food drives and blood drives, and participates in the Adopt a Family program. Jenna Schott is a top teen award winner from Columbus High School. As a Mercy One Medical Center volunteer, Jenna has held numerous roles from interacting directly with patients in the surgical unit to assisting the Human Resources Office with clerical duties. Julia Thierry is a top teen award winner from Don Bosco High School. Julia has volunteered to serve meals at Catholic Worker House, Feed My Starving Children, and Northeast Iowa Food Bank. Haley Thurman is a top teen award winner from Columbus High School, where she participated in cheerleading, theater, and choir. Aaliyah Turner is a top teen award winner for Cedar Falls High School. She and her family host annual lemonade and bake sale events to raise money for Alive and Running Suicide Awareness and Prevention and the American Cancer Society's Relay for Life. Megan Wheelock is a top teen award winner from Valley Lutheran High School. She has dedicated 170 hours to community service. Kyla Wright is a top teen award winner from Waterloo West High School. She helped children at her school's cheerleading clinic and was a counselor through her church's vacation Bible school. Brooke Zoll is a top teen award winner from Don Bosco High School. She is involved with the Youth Action Council of Cedar Valley, which has allowed her to serve with the National Iowa Food Bank and Manor Care Nursing Home. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.